Good morning. The court will now hear oral argument in the case of United States v. Schumacher. Counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Major Kirk Sipigno, and I, along with Captain Paul LeBlanc, represent the appellant, Staff Sergeant Schumacher. Chief Judge Baker, with the court's permission, I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Ma'am, gentlemen, this case, like many cases or all cases tried in the American jury system, was about competing stories. Stories that the jury had to choose from in order to determine the ultimate question of what the truth was. One of those possible stories, one of those potential stories that Staff Sergeant Schumacher was relying on, was a story of self-defense. He was trying to weave this story together from facts presented by the government, but the jury never considered this particular story. They didn't consider it because the judge, on his own, determined that the story of self-defense was not reasonable, and he refused to give the instruction. This was not a trivial error. As this court's well aware, the authority of the jury to make the decision on the ultimate question of a defendant's guilt is enshrined and sacred in American jurisprudence. This court has recognized that in its test that it created to determine whether a defense, an affirmative defense,
do you think the issue here is one of differences of view about what the law requires, or is this a difference of view about what the facts indicate in terms of whether the threshold was met for the instruction?
This is about whether or not the facts were sufficient to meet the instruction, but the judge down below and the lower court both applied the wrong standard. In fact, they evaluated the reasonableness of the defense when, in fact, they were supposed to evaluate whether there was, as this court has articulated many times, some evidence of the defense that the jury may attach credit to.
That the jury may attach credit to, does that mean, what do they do with subsection A and the words on reasonable grounds?
Well, I think, Your Honor, they have to, you know, it's not clear how much what credit means. I mean, this is perhaps one of the lowest standards, and understandably so, for triggering the next step, which is to instruct the jury and give them the instruction. They need to find that it was reasonable, but there needs to be, not that it was reasonable, but rather there was some evidence that he reasonably believed that. And in this case, there was, and it came from the government's own witnesses, Your Honor.
So you're not saying it's surplusage?
No, it's not surplusage.
Okay, it means something.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that this court has crafted a rule, and incidental to the way the court has crafted it, is a guarantee of the decision-making authority of the jury. In other words, this low standard that the court has created is not without purpose.
The judge is supposed to do something with the word reasonable. You just don't agree with what he's done.
Yeah, I think that he determined on his own whether it was reasonable, and that's not what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to determine whether there's some evidence that the jury may attach credit to for the
some evidence that he could reasonably have apprehended.
Yes, Your Honor, and the totality of the circumstances is really what we look at, as this court explained in Hibbard, which the government cited as supplemental authority. You know, in Hibbard, the only evidence was that at the end he kind of says, there's a sexual encounter to porn, at the end he says, well, at least that was consensual. And this court said that was clearly just him trying to recast the facts in a more favorable light.
Okay, here's the appellant. He's sitting in his garage. He knows the MPs are on the way. He is cleaning his weapons, which he allegedly does for relaxation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Here come the MPs. They know, they've been told he has weapons. Now what is reasonable about the appellant's apprehending that somehow mayhem is going to be done to him by these two police officers?
Well, I think Your Honor brings up a very good point, that is specifically that there are lots of facts that could be weighed here and determine whether or not it was reasonable for him to believe that. And when we start to weigh those facts, that is really the exact function that the jury is supposed to be doing.
But counsel, the rule itself talks about objective standard, right?
Yes,
so if it's objectively not reasonable for him to have reasonably apprehended that harm was to be inflicted, let alone inflicted wrongfully, how is that substituting his own view for that of the jury when, if you look at the entirety of the discussion on the record, it's clear it was anything but what you're saying?
Well, I think that, and we don't necessarily concede that it was completely unreasonable for Tim to argue self-defense, Your Honor. He was aware that the police were coming, but he thought that they were coming in response to this sort of ridiculously childish argument that they were having. Now, as the government has pointed out, and the government's own witness pointed out, she didn't think they were going to come in the house. She said, we should go outside because the MPs are coming. In other words, we should go outside and meet the MPs because she doesn't believe that they're coming to the home, or they wouldn't come into the home. And then the government proffered testimony from that very same witness that talked for several paragraphs about how she did not believe they would come in.
But how is it objectively reasonable under the facts and circumstances of this case for the appellant to have objectively reasonably believed that the police coming with a drawn weapon were about to shoot him?
I think when we look at, Your Honor, the facts of the case, and we see that it was a very frenetic and hectic situation. It was not as the government sort of makes it out to be, or at least it could have been interpreted as an incident where these military police appeared out of nowhere. This was the crux of the defense's case. They put in all sorts of picture evidence about what could be seen from the particular vantage points, and
is there any indication he didn't know they were MPs?
There is, Your Honor. I mean, they know that he's coming, but they appear suddenly.
They appear suddenly. Well, who else was expected?
Well, he didn't testify, obviously, but he was standing right next to Second Lieutenant KD, who was the government's witness, who said she didn't know
who was his wife and with whom he was having a screaming match that could be heard all over the neighborhood and ended up in the neighbors calling the police.
That's just a question of clarification.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I understood the defense, it was based on the fact that the assumption that they thought there were intruders at a certain point. Is that your contention that appellant thought they were intruders, or is your contention that he thought they were intruders and or MPs acting outside the law in some manner?
I think that, and maybe I'm not making myself clear enough, that he believed potentially there was intruders. At least that argument can be made, that there's some evidence.
Now, do you agree that there came a time when it's clear that he understood that they were MPs?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes.
At what time, in your view, did that come?
After they saw the peers, from reading the record. Lance Corporal Leff talks about how he is even having trouble identifying himself when he shows up. He says, I tried to identify myself as a military policeman, but it was hard considering all the screaming that was going on. And at that point is when he's sort of popping back and forth from outside behind the cover of the door.
Because the weapon was being brandished by the appellant.
I mean, he thinks at that point, Staff Sergeant Schumacher, now this is a combat trained Marine, he's just trying to figure out what is going on, essentially.
So do you contest whether the appellant said at some time words to the effect of, I've killed people in combat? What's wrong with killing a few MPs?
The record seems to be clear that he said that. I mean, I think the question is really, when did the assault occur, and what did he believe at the time of the assault? And this was really...
What is the best fact for you that the assault occurred before he said that versus after?
Well, they never actually tell. I mean, it appears to be part of the whole screaming or after the screaming. We're not sure. It looks like after the MPs identified themselves, I mean, he couldn't have said, I killed a few MPs. Killing a few MPs is nothing to me if he hadn't known at that point, that they were MPs. But the assault appears to happen in the initial confusing moments of the encounter, Your Honor. And that really...
Counsel, you gave two answers to Judge Baker. So I want to get clear on this. In the defense view, did the assault take place before or after the defendant, in this case, was said to have made a comment recognizing that there were MPs present in the room?
After, it appears, Your Honor, and from the facts of the case.
So in your view, he knew they were MPs and then he committed the assault?
No, I'm sorry.
That's what I'm trying to get straight here. When did the assault, from the defense perspective, occur, and what in the record establishes that?
I think the evidence...
Before or after he made a comment about recognizing that they were MPs?
I think he assaults them before he makes the comment.
Well, counsel, what do you do about the record at page 463 when the military judge asked the defense counsel, there's no evidence that he was not aware that they were MPs at the time he brandished the weapon, is there? Am I missing something? And then the counsel goes on to say, no, I agree with you on that point part of that aspect, yes. But in my opinion, from my research, if I can say it this way, to a number of civil rights cases, you are absolutely allowed to defend yourself against excessive use of force by the police, which is a different theory of the case than you gave in response to Judge Baker's question as to whether this was, he thought they were intruders or they thought that they were MPs about to run amok.
Well, that is a civilian defense counsel at trial.
You would agree that you can have a different theory here, but
yes,
we are stuck with the theory that's in the record.
Well, my understanding is that this court should review the instructions given to Novo, Your Honor.
Well, we review them to Novo, but we review them in the context of what we're determining is whether the instructions were appropriate based on the facts in the record of the actual case.
I mean, that's correct, Your Honor.
And part of that is the theory of the case, and part of that is what the defense counsel acknowledged and conceded at trial, which is, seems to be supported by the record.
Well, he was originally trying to get a blanket self-defense instruction, appears from the record, Your Honor, but he sort of has to change and modify it as it, the case goes on. I mean, the judge is clearly not amenable to giving a self-defense instruction, and he's applying what appears to be the incorrect standard, the standard not articulated by this particular court. And that's really the issue. I mean, he can't get a self-defense instruction, and that's really what he needs. His whole case is about self-defense.
Counsel, where in the record did the defense counsel say, based upon the evidence in this case, particularly the evidence of the government's witness, that is, the wife of the defendant, the people inside the house apprehended that there were intruders, and they responded with self-defense. Where did the defense counsel articulate that theory for the judge, as opposed to the excessive force theory identified by Judge Ryan?
Yes, Your Honor. He doesn't articulate that theory in particular. But the question is...
Would you agree that it's the theory that they were intruders that would make it objectively unreasonable, that it would make it objectively reasonable for him to be under apprehension? As opposed to that it would be objectively reasonable for him to brandish a weapon if he knew they were MPs?
Yes, Your Honor. The intruder aspect of it is what raises the self-defense issue. And as this court has articulated, it looks at the totality of the circumstances. And the theory that is articulated by the defense is one question that is addressed when determining whether or not the instruction should be
given. So the defense theory in this case is that the wife's testimony establishes that the people inside the house apprehended that there were intruders, and that even though the defense counsel did not request an instruction on that basis, and even though the defense counsel seemed to actually reject that and focus on excessive use of force, the military judge erred in not giving the instruction because the military judge didn't perceive what the defense counsel didn't perceive. I know you're not arguing it that way, but go ahead and take a shot.
Yeah, the defense counsel below, as this court has articulated, his theory is not necessarily dispositive on the issue. I mean, the issue really becomes whether or not the members potentially would have acquitted this defendant on these facts. You know, and he was precluded from even arguing self-defense from the judge. You know, he had to kind of give this weak, watered-down closing argument with respect to, you know, this is a combat trained Marine and he did what he did. Well, I think that had been presented with it, the theory of self-defense as we've articulated it, potentially would have changed the situation. And therein really lies the prejudice. I mean, when we talk about the judicial sort of economy of this rule that this court has crafted, it is very, 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 very effective in that it provides a guarantee that if ever a defense should be considered, it is in fact considered by the jury. And this gives the overall court-martial proceedings extra legitimacy, you know, more legitimacy, or however you want to put it, in a sense that when the public looks back at a trial like this, they say, well, what about self-defense, you know, it was raised. If the jury had just been instructed on self-defense, it would have been raised, considered, and rejected, and the public could have full confidence in the guilty verdict that was obtained.
Just to be clear, do you agree with the following statement that some evidence is a matter of law as it relates to each element of a defense?
Yes, sir. I mean, it appears to me that the judge...
So you're not arguing in a colloquial sense. You just disagree as to whether that threshold's been met. But there's agreement on that.
Yes, sir. I mean, then it does appear to be the correct standard, and it doesn't appear to be the standard that the military judge applied or the lower court applied in reviewing the conviction. They mixed together the question of whether the defense was proved. And that question really is about for the jury to decide, as we've discussed.
The CCA concludes, or whatever they do, they state on page 6, there is no evidence in the record that demonstrates the appellant pointed his weapon at Lance Corporal J.F. until after he knew who they were. What would you point in the record as suggesting that's incorrect?
The testimony of Lance Corporal J.F. himself, is what I would point to, Your Honor. Specifically, he talks about how confusing the situation is. And this is not a situation where, you know, that happened lockstep, one military police walk in, two identify, three recognition of identity. They're pointing guns at each other, they're yelling at each other, the appellant is drunk, and although obviously the reasonable person standard applies, and that can be considered with respect to whether or not he's recognizing whether these people are, in fact, military police or armed intruders. They're dressed like anybody else. And Lance Corporal F and Katie, both the government's witnesses, both talk about how frenetic the situation is. And chaos. There's guns are everywhere, and no one really knows what's going on.
So you're saying you would not point to any specific statement or evidence, but say that in the context of confusion, we can't know. Is that what your argument is?
Yeah, in the context of confusion, that is exactly the kind of question that the jury is meant to resolve. But Lance Corporal F's testimony does talk about when he's pointing the weapon at him, and he talks about it all within the context of the initial encounter when he's popping back and forth and he's pointing the weapon, he's presenting the weapon at him. Now, it doesn't appear to be anywhere else that he talks about pointing the gun afterwards. And so I think that, frankly, the lower court got that factual finding wrong. I mean, the facts suggest that he was pointing the weapon at him when Lance Corporal F was trying to make entry and identify himself. Once he does, he turns the weapon on himself. He threatens to sort of kill himself and some other things, but he turns the weapon on himself and threatens himself. Now, he does say these other words, these threats, but it doesn't appear that he has pointed the weapon at him again at that point.
Let's talk about the role of the lower court in making factual findings. Is the lower court entitled to make a factual finding that's binding on this court with respect to a matter that is an issue of law? That is, if the question is whether a matter should or should not have been submitted to the court-martial panel for them to decide the factual situation, can the lower court make a factual finding at that point, or is it operating as a court of law and determining whether the facts upon which the military judge made his ruling were not clearly erroneously stated by the military judge?
I believe it's operating as a court of law. Now, the fact-finding power, the factual sufficiency power that the lower court, the sort of unique power it has, is with respect to affirming, whether they are beyond reasonable doubt. Now, this is a question of law that this court can address. You can look at all the facts and say, well, we don't believe that, according to the testimony of Lance Corporal F, Schumacher pointing the gun at Lance Corporal F again after the initial confusing moments of the encounter.
So just to be clear, is the evidence that you can point to in the record that the appellant pointed his weapon before he knew who they were, that it was confusing?
Well, it was confusing, but also it's not clear when he says that sort of threat, Your Honor. It is clear when he points a weapon at him. He points a weapon at him right at the start of the encounter, and I think that based off of Second Lieutenant KD's testimony and Lance Corporal F's testimony, that was occurring when this confusion was going on.
And what is your view as to what were to do with the defense counsel's concessions and assertions with respect to the facts during the actual court-martial, as opposed to your interpretation of the facts today?
Well, it certainly should obviously weigh in. And as this court has explained, the defense counsel's theory weighs into the overall totality of the circumstances, but is not necessarily dispositive.
Just out of curiosity, how was the military judge to discern this theory of self-defense when it was one specifically rejected by the defense counsel?
Well, and I see my time is about up. May I answer that question, Your Honor?
Of course.
Well, there's a couple of answers to that question. The judge is required, as this court's well aware, to instruct on any affirmative defense that is in issue. So I think with absent a direct waiver from the defense counsel, he should instruct on it. I think that the facts that I've enunciated that were in front of the military judge, and he really applied the wrong standard. He just said it wasn't reasonable. So I think the facts were there to suggest self-defense. He just missed them, perhaps. Thank you very much.
Chief Judge Baker, and may it please the Court, my name is Lieutenant Ritesh Srivastava, and along with Colonel Kurt Brubaker, we represent the government. Your Honors, for the following four reasons, there was no evidence that on objective, reasonable grounds, the appellant could have apprehended that harm was about to be inflicted on him. First, both he and his wife knew that the MPs were on their way to his home. Second, the MPs showed up to their home in 4 minutes after being called from the neighbor's house, dressed in their complete military police gear. Third, moments before the MPs showed up, the appellant's wife pleaded with him to come outside the house so they could meet the MPs out there and avoid having them see the appellant with his guns. And fourth, the appellant threatened the MPs before he assaulted them that I've killed people before and it's nothing for me to kill a few MPs. Thus, no instruction was warranted, and even if this was error, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. To warrant a self-defense instruction in this case, there had to be some evidence on the first element of self-defense that the accused apprehended on reasonable grounds that bodily harm was about to be wrongfully inflicted. This court has stated in cases such as United States versus Curtis that this is an objective inquiry.
You said that they came 4 minutes later in their full military police gear.
Yes,
which uniform were they wearing?
They were wearing their camouflage, Your Honor.
Okay, and you said they the facts are clear that the threat to the MPs occurred after, or the assault occurred after, the words saying I've killed other people and what's how about some MPs or whatever. What's the documentation for that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Both the MPs testified that as soon as they showed up to the house, they were barking orders at the appellant. As soon as they saw him with the weapons, that they were asking him, they said, military police, drop your weapons, and it was in that initial context where he replied, it's nothing for me to kill a few MPs. And, Your Honors, that is on...
Are you looking for the statement about the MPs, or are you looking for something that demonstrates that he brandishes the weapon after that?
The latter, Your Honor. And that is on, Your Honors. The record sites are page 249, 282, 283 through 285, and record site page 306. Those are the testimonies of both the MPs, which establishes that when they first got there, they were ordering the appellant that military police drop your weapons, and it was in those initial moments before the assault occurs where he then also responds, I've killed people before, it's nothing for me to kill a few MPs.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
What about the testimony of another government witness in this case, the other person who was in the room? She said, record page 211, that she told them to get out. She doesn't remember what they said. She doesn't remember what they were wearing, that she didn't know what they were wearing. In effect, she didn't know at that point who they were. And she said, they just scared the crap out of me. I don't know who these two people are that just barged into the house and had weapons on me. Did not remember hearing them identify themselves as MPs. Now, that's the government's witness. Is that testimony that the panel could credit?
No, Your Honor. And
so the government presented testimony at trial that they wanted to present at trial, but now the government doesn't want any credit given to it on appeal.
No, Your Honor, she does make that statement. That is correct, Your Honor. However, if the rest of her testimony reveals that even she didn't honestly believe what she was saying. Namely, Your Honor, at one point while she's on the stand, she says, even as the MPs came in and right in those initial moments, she asks her husband to drop his weapons because, and this theory goes on from this witness on numerous points, which is that she wanted to avoid a perception problem, that the MPs would see her husband with the weapons and that they would think something was going wrong when in fact that wasn't the case. And so what happens is right at that point, she says, when they first came in, I asked my husband to drop his weapons, and the trial counsel asks, well, but wait, why would you want your husband to do that? You thought these were armed intruders. Why would you want him to drop his weapons and not instead keep those weapons to defend you? And she's unable to answer the question, and she stutters, and the record just fades off because she...
Yeah, but she didn't disavow her earlier testimony, and if she, the government witness, didn't know who these people were, why wouldn't it have been reasonable for the defendant in this case to not know who they were, or at least to let the court-martial panel determine whether that was the case or not?
Because, Your Honor, we must still view the evidence through the lens of objectivity.
And so is the question then, counsel, whether, regardless of what the wife said, whether it was objectively reasonable for her to not know who they were in light of the fact that a 911 call had been made and that they arrived 4 minutes later?
No, Your Honor, it's applicable to both the appellant and to her, that both of them knew very well, and this is uncontroverted, Your Honor, that they both knew that the MPs had been called, and in fact they showed up 4 minutes after the phone call was made. It's also apparent that she herself doesn't believe this testimony, and Your Honor, Judge Arfon to go back.
So she said, oh, I either lied or I was mistaken earlier. At what point does she disavow her earlier testimony as opposed to giving answers that the government now perceives as inconsistent with her earlier testimony?
She doesn't disavow it, Your Honor, but her rest of her testimony contradicts her initial bare-bones assertion on this point. And this is very similar to United States versus Curtis, where this court found that even where the appellant had made a subjective allegation that he thought that the victim had kicked him, therefore he thought he was in an honest fear of harm, this court found that the appellant's subsequent testimony on cross revealed that he, in fact, wasn't in fear. And he never expressly disavowed it, but at the same time, the rest of his testimony showed on cross that he wasn't in fear, and in fact, he had pulled the victim back towards him and stabbed her multiple times, revealing that despite his subjective allegation that he was in fear, that the rest of his testimony revealed, in fact, that he wasn't.
Yeah, I understand that, but these aren't questions that the defense asked or that the witness volunteered on her own. These are express questions asked by the government right at the outset of her testimony to set the context.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. This was elicited by the government counsel. But, Your Honor, we would maintain that fact, if viewed in a vacuum, that assertion, if viewed in a vacuum, certainly could be objective, but when viewed through the lens of objectivity, it doesn't pass muster.
Counsel, I don't have the defense opening or closing in front of me. Are you familiar with what it contains?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was the defense theory of the case that the appellant was brandishing a weapon because he believed that there were intruders, or was it that he thought that the MPs were going to kill him?
Your Honor, initially, in his opening, the defense crafts two theories. One is that the MPs were, the MP, Lance Corporal F, who was crouched taking cover behind the door, that he didn't have the right angle so that he couldn't exactly see if this assault really actually occurred. That's one. Second, he then tries to develop this theory that there was confusion or surprise in the beginning, and that's why they may have thought that these people were somebody else instead of being MPs. But later the defense counsel actually abandons the initial theory, which is that these people were armed intruders, and he focuses then on the fact that the MPs may have exceeded their bounds or have potentially been acting unlawfully.
And by the time that the discussion with respect to the instructions was made before the military judge, at that point in time, what was the defense theory?
At that point, Your Honor, the defense's theory was that this was a case where the appellant believed that these people were that these MPs were potentially acting outside their scope of their duties, that they were acting unlawfully. And Your Honors, even assuming if it was error to not instruct, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because the appellant's wife established herself as a witness with no credibility whatsoever. Appellant was also charged with assaulting his wife, and she maintained, at trial, she maintained that the appellant never pointed his weapons at her, that she was never the victim of this assault. Despite this insistence, the members found the appellant guilty of assaulting her. They believed the testimony of the MPs that the appellant had assaulted the MPs as well as the wife. Secondly, Your Honor, the members rejected.
Counsel, is that a then make it a legal impossibility that the members could have believed her as to one part of her testimony and not believed her as to another part of the testimony?
No, Your Honor. Certainly, they could have. It's not a legal impossibility. But Your Honor, the members effectively rejected the self-defense instruction when they also found the appellant guilty of violating Article 92 of lawful order, which was that the appellant did not drop his weapons when the MPs told him to drop his weapons. And that means, Your Honors, that the members found beyond a reasonable doubt that the appellant knew that there was a lawful order given to him by the military police. And for those reasons, Your Honor, there's no question that any error in this case, if it existed, did not contribute to this conviction.
You're welcome to consult if you'd like to, or hand and arm signals are fine.
Unless there are any further questions, government. This concludes the government.
Sorry. Rebuttal.
Just
I think it's instructive that the government spent about 9 minutes of its argument talking about the facts of this case. It didn't talk about the facts of the case and why the self-defense defense was not reasonable. That very discussion that the government had would have been wonderful for the jury to have in order to make the ultimate determination of appellant's guilt. There are two stories that could be told here, but only one was considered. And respectfully, Appellant Schumacher requests this court set aside his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted, and we will stand in recess for till 10 past. Okay? Thanks very much.
Court stands in recess until 10:10.